Raymond brought us an excellent lesson, and it's one that there's a lot of differences on and so forth. I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions, so we want to remember our procedure before we start the discussion. If you want to make a comment, you know, raise your hand and we will take note of it. And then when you are recognized, stand in the microphone will be brought to you and make your comments short. And after the initial statement or comment, you have two rebuttals, and those are to be short because there's a number of people that might want to ask questions. And we don't want one person to dominate all the time. So after you have your opportunity, then we will pass it around to others. And if we have time and you still want to talk, we'll come back to you. So at this time, we'll take discussion. Randy, Tibor, Jimmy Cutter.
Raymond, you talked a lot about eating meat, oftentimes. Today, would you make a statement one way or the other, is it wrong to eat meat oftentimes?
It's not wrong, is your conscience not offended by it?
I disagree. I believe there's more to it than that. That's right, and that's the reason I wanted to bring that up. I didn't find the passage, but you know the passage I'm I would ask you to consider Revelation chapter 2 and at verse 20, the letter to the church at Thyatira. He says, "Nevertheless, I have a few things against you because you allow that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, to teach and seduce my servants to commit sexual immorality and eat things sacrificed to idols." Is it possible that the deal was, you don't have to, if you don't know it's offered to an idol, you don't just not eat meat because it might have been offered to an idol. But if you do know it was offered to an idol, then you abstain. I don't know. I'm really asking. That's the deal, the letter of what Jesus said to the church.
I think contextually, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul is talking about meat that people knew had been offered to idols, because they bought it in the marketplace where that meat was sold. The reason why you wouldn't ask questions for conscience sake is you wouldn't ask questions to enter into disputable matters. But in Revelation chapter 20, contextually, he's talking about people who are committing idolatry and committing fornication, which was a sin that was exercised in the worship of idols. So the context there is idolatry. And I would say that in Revelation chapter 2, verse 20, the eating of meat offered to idols would be eating meat that had been offered to idols. And the eating of that meat, the eating of it, would be done in the worship of idols. And that was part of their practice, is to have suppers, to have meals, and to commit fornication, to have drunken orgies in worship of their idols. And so I would say that the eating of meat there in Revelation 20, contextually, would have to be an idolatrous practice.
Jimmy Cutter and Alex.
Raymond, I agree with Cliff. It was a good study, and I like the way you made it simple, because I don't think we have to make this a complicated study. I think it is something that we can apply to our lives in a very clear way. You know, my dad owns a farm, and he's got a fence around that farm on the boundaries. But it's his right, if he wanted to move that fence in 100 yards all the way around the boundaries. But it's not his right to insist that his neighbors do it. If he wants to do that, that's up to him. Nobody should criticize him for that. But he shouldn't insist on his neighbors doing that. And I think that's what happens when moral principles, like you said, they have boundaries. We shouldn't think that moral principles don't have boundaries. They do. But if we want to
liberties, you mean have moral boundaries.
Principles have moral boundaries as well. I mean, we just can't, like you said, do anything.
Right.
But if we want to move the boundary in, that's our liberty. But we become like the Pharisees when we insist that then becomes the moral principle boundary, you see. But let me ask you about this. What
is... Let me make a comment on that, because I want to clarify something, because that's really not what I was saying. What I was saying was, I mean, moral principles obviously have boundaries, because moral principles are boundaries, right, themselves. But what I was saying was liberties have boundaries to them made up of moral principles. Those moral principles provide the boundaries for the liberties. Within this realm, we have choices to make. You know, in that property where that your dad has that property, the fenced area, he can do what he wants inside that fenced area. But he can't, he can build a house if he wants to, or he can tear one down, but he can't go over to the neighbor's property and do the same thing. So he can make choices in this area within those bounds, but he can't make choices outside. And that's the same thing is true, like, for instance, the modest apparel, right? The scriptures give us principles for choosing what kind of clothing we're going to wear. But within certain moral principles. And the first Corinthians, or 1 Timothy chapter 2 gives us the moral principles that provide the boundaries. Within that realm, we can make decisions about exactly what we want to wear, as long as they come within those moral grounds.
Well, I think that's what I was saying. I didn't think I was saying anything different. Okay. I'm just saying you could, within the moral principles, move the boundaries in.
Well,
but you can't insist on someone else having those boundaries in.
Right, that's precisely the clarification I wanted to make. That we can't move these boundaries, right? These boundaries stay the same.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. But we can choose to not go to the boundaries.
Okay, all right.
Let me ask you this. Let's suppose that in Ephesus, someone bought meat offered to an idol, and he would take it home and he would eat it. Now, that's okay. Paul said it was okay. We all agree that it's a liberty. But would it be all right, then, if he bought these little idols that this meat was offered to, little replicas of it, brought it home, and he would set it up at home while he was eating this meat and say, well, I don't believe in these gods, and I know that these gods are nothing. I believe in the true God, but I'm going to eat this meat. And I want you to answer that in connection with Christmas as well, giving the gifts and then setting up the tree.
Well, obviously with statues, with idols, there's immediate recognition of what that statue represents. My first question to a brother like that would be, why do you have it there? And what do you intend to do with that statue? I mean, and ask him what his purpose was. What's the purpose of having that statue there in the first place? And because there's an immediate identification with the statue and the idol. There's an immediate identification. Because those statues universally represent idolatry to the people. But take, for instance, a Christmas tree. My father-in-law, who's not a Christian, we hope he does become a Christian one day, always has a Christmas tree in his home. And you know what? It doesn't bother me at all to go into his home and sit next to that Christmas tree and smell it and say, the Christmas tree looks really nice, or your tree looks really nice. The reason for that is because there's no direct relationship between that tree and the worship of the tree. My father-in-law would never think that he's worshiping a tree by having it there. To them, him, that's an adornment. When I go in there, I know that all that means to him is just a simple, a traditional adornment that he puts in his house. And so I'm not going to judge him on the basis of whether he has a tree in his house or not. I don't have a tree, but I'm not going to judge him whether he has a tree in his house or not. And I'm not going to, when I sit down and have Bible studies with him, I don't talk about whether he should have a Christmas tree in his house or not. I talk to him about salvation and about what Jesus should mean to him in his life. And so, you always have to ask yourself, here's the key right here. Define descriptive characteristics about idolatry. Is it, or about a Christmas tree? You have to define exactly what you're talking about. If you were to condemn a Christmas tree in that particular context, ask, does it have the descriptive qualities of idolatry? Does it have the descriptive qualities of idolatry in that particular setting? And that's all you'd have to raise. I mean, I'm raising this as a question.
He didn't answer my question. I wanted to know if a Christian had one, though. A Christian had one, not an unbeliever.
You'd have to do the same thing. You'd have to define the descriptive qualities of that. First of all, you'd have to define whether a Christian meant to worship that tree as an idol, or whether it could be contextually compared with the passage in the Old Testament that's connected with idolatry. And then you would have to ask yourself the question, whether by that Christian having it in their house, that another Christian might say, well, I guess it's okay, and put one up in their house, and then think they're sinning in the back of their mind by having it in their house. But here's what you have to start with. The descriptive qualities. And that's any discussion. We can have a discussion about that. It's fine with me. A discussion about Christmas trees. But here's where the discussion has to lie. Specifically, where it has to focus is on defining the descriptive, relevant descriptive qualities of that. Not just that it's a tree and they worship trees back there, because I have trees in my front lawn. I have my trees in my yard, you know, and sometimes kids come by and paper the trees. And that's not idolatry. And so I have to define the descriptive qualities and ask myself that question. But I mean, I'm willing to discuss it. You know, I'm not. This is what this is all about.
Okay, Alex, and then Greg Brian.
Yeah, I would like you to elaborate on verses 14 through 22 of 1 Corinthians 10. Since he has already talked about the import of a meat offered to idol, if you have the knowledge, it means nothing. However, those verses seem to somewhat balance what a person with knowledge would have thought, and perhaps you know, gives him another guide to evaluate his actions. I don't know, you know, could you elaborate on that?
Well, all I can explain, Alex, is maybe the relationship between this is 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 14 to 22. Paul talks about idolatry and how different our worship is than pagan worship. But in verse 23, he makes a transition, and that transition is the statement: everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. And it's as if somebody had raised this as an argument. It sounds to me like somebody had raised this as an argument, saying, but everything is permissible, isn't it? Quoting somebody. In fact, he repeats it twice as if he is quoting from some argument that somebody had made. And he says, it's as if he's saying, granted for the sake of argument, everything's permissible, but not everything's beneficial. Or if everything may be permissible, but not everything's constructive. Not saying in reality, he's not wanting to say in reality that idolatry that he just talked about was permissible. But instead, like granting for the sake of argument, if somebody were to say everything is permissible, the fact is not everything is constructive or not everything is beneficial. And what's not beneficial is when we cause people to sin.
Okay, Greg Brange and then George Batty.
I know that's probably not as much as you wanted, Alex, but I...
My question has to do with the definition of the occasion to fall or the stumbling block. If this means to cause to fall or sin, and if I understand correctly that this is the same Greek word, Matthew 16:23, where Jesus has predicted his death, Peter says, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. And he turned and said unto him, Peter, get thee behind me, Satan, for thou art an offense unto me. And NIV says a stumbling block. How do you explain or use that definition to describe what Jesus said?
Good question, Brent. That word is the word scandalizo, which means a snare or a trap. It said a snare or a trap for somebody. And by influencing Peter to say this, Lord, this will never happen to you, when the Lord was announcing his death. And Peter says, no, this will never happen to you. But Jesus recognized that as a snare to him. As if Peter saying that might get him to think, well, everything's going to be okay. Maybe I won't have to die. And then he would give up his guard, so to speak. And it would be a snare to him. That way. Did you want to make a rebuttal or something?
No.
I guess my point is, then it is means more of an occasion to fall or opportunity to sin than to actually sin itself. I believe we all agree he never sinned. Therefore, the fact that Peter was a stumbling block to him did not cause him to sin, but rather presented the occasion for him to do that.
It provided him the opportunity for him to sin, right? And theoretically, any liberty, I mean, you have to be careful on this point, because theoretically, any liberty whatsoever can be an occasion for somebody to stumble. Right, that's what Paul's saying, an occasion for somebody to stumble. But in all the examples that he's giving us in 1 Corinthians 10 and 1 Corinthians 8, he's talking about people who actually sin by participating in the activity. That's what was contextually what was happening. They sin by participating in the activity. And that's how they wounded their conscience. They wound their conscience. And obviously, Christ's conscience was not wounded either in Matthew chapter 16. So we're talking about just a little bit different kind of a case for that reason.
Okay. George and Jim.
Raymond, on your left side of this chart, doesn't it need to be broken down one more time into positive law versus and moral principles versus liberty? Because you gave the example of using instrumental music in singing as a moral principle, and I think that's a positive law. Moral principles don't change from age to age. They stay the same all the way through. And positive law changes. That's why we can use, or that's why we insist that singing with instruments is wrong today, but it wasn't wrong for the Hebrews. But if you don't make that distinction, it looks like we're doing something that used to be, or we're doing, they did something that used to be immoral, and now we're being moral and they weren't. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is that a valid, to me, I think what we should say is if God specifically said something, then there is no choice to make. But if he did not specify, then we have choices. If he specified something moral or positive, then we don't have a choice. We just have to do it because he said so.
You can say that, George. But I'm using the word moral principle in a much broader sense. I'm using it in the sense of anything that God says or doesn't say. You know, God's silence, too, is morally binding. Anything that is obligating to us, anything in God's will that is obligating to us, is our moral principle as a Christian. And it could be, as you might want to call, positive law, but our moral principles don't come from the Old Testament. I think that's the distinction you have to make, first of all, is that our moral principles come from the New Testament code. And so moral principles that we have as Christians involve anything that for us is obligated and universal. Because that's the very nature of a moral principle. A moral principle is something that's obligating and universal. And sometimes we make these distinctions to be able to clarify our position on different issues. But I particularly... and just using moral principle in this broadest sense.
Well, I would break it down a little bit. For the sake, see, I believe there are some positive laws that apply just to Christians, and they are not universal. And people get into their mind, for example, the divorce regulations, and they think this is a moral principle that applies to all men, so we baptize somebody that's in, you know, they've been divorced, and some of our people say that's a moral principle that they have violated in their past and they can never be married. And I think that's dangerous just to label everything as a moral principle. And I think we need to break it down to positive laws and moral laws.
Well, and when let me clarify this. When I talk about more universal, what I mean actually is when you say you ought to do something, that you must do it, then you believe that others in the same similar moral realm ought to do the same thing. It's universal in that sense. It's not something just for you. It's universal in the sense of contrasting with individual. Right. So I would agree that there are laws that we have as Christians that are universal in the sense that they apply to all Christians, because we're the ones within the moral code of Christianity.
I had just one more question. Is it Daniel chapter 3 with those three Hebrew boys that were... Suppose the day all that music started playing, everybody fell down in front of that idol. obviously, if they fall down in front of the idol, they're not going to be influencing anybody because everybody's already fallen down. So it's not a matter of will I influence somebody. And in their own mind, they know the idol is nothing. It's just a big chunk of metal up there. And so could they then bow down before the idol, even though they know in their own mind it's nothing, I'm not going to be influencing anybody else around me. It's just real convenient to go ahead and bow down because there's that furnace over there waiting for me. You know, how could... It looks to me like there are times where you know there's nothing wrong here, you're not going to be influencing anybody, you still don't do it anyway. I don't think they refused to bow just because of their own conscience.
If you do that though, if you refuse to participate, it has to be on the basis of a moral principle. So you have to be able to tell yourself, why am I not participating? You know, what am I doing here that's sin? What would I be doing here that's sin? To me, they would be violating moral principles in that they're, you might be able to say that nobody would know that they didn't fall down, but I think people would know that they fell down. And I don't know if anybody looks around, looked around back then when they're worshiping idols like people look around today when they're praying, but I think people would know. Some way they'd find out. And clearly, by them standing up and making that distinction, they felt they were morally obligated to stand up and make that distinction of who they are. So there's other moral principles that may come into involved.
Jim Kraus, Ben Allen, maybe.
Thank you, Randy. 1 Corinthians 10:25 that Randy brought up, this is, I think, is a specific situation. We have an unbeliever who says to you, here's some meat that's been offered to idols. And Paul says very clearly, the reason you don't eat is for the sake of that man's conscience, not your own conscience. And so that particular situation, maybe it's because the unbeliever is testing you to see whether you will eat, or by eating you might in some way hurt your influence with that individual or leave the wrong impression. Because he does not have the knowledge, he doesn't have the trained conscience to know that this would be a liberty. And so Paul is not saying that any time you know meat's been offered to an idol, that you can't eat it. He's just simply saying in this situation, for the sake of the other man's conscience, not that it would be wrong for you, since you know it's offered to idols, but for the sake of his conscience, not your own, don't eat.
Did you want me to comment on
yes,
that?
Yes, please.
In verse 27, he says, if some unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you without raising questions for conscience sake. But if anyone says to you, and I'm not sure he's talking about the unbeliever there, I've always thought maybe he's talking about a Christian, a weaker Christian, who comes to you and says, who's there too with you eating.
That could apply also.
And he says, because he's the one that actually would have the conscience, right? The unbeliever wouldn't have a conscience about it.
Unless the unbeliever knows that you're a Christian and he's just kind of testing you to see what your reaction will be.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be the same as having a conscience.
I guess
right?
That's probably right.
Because having a conscience would say that you think it's something's wrong,
right,
and by
true,
doing it you would be
true,
offending your conscience. And okay, so he would. It's like you're sitting down to a meal with another Christian who is weak and you're eating the meat. And the Christian who's eating, this other Christian says to you, you know, this meat has been offered to idols. And when he says that to you, you think, uh-oh, this guy may have a weak conscience. You know, so better not to eat then. So that's the picture I have contextually from what's going on there. But I may be wrong, but I have the idea that it's a weak Christian that makes that remark as he's eating, because it's in the eating that he sins.
Either way, it's not your knowledge of whether or not the meat's been offered to idols that makes it wrong.
Right.
It's the specific situation and the other person knowledge that has been offered to idols and their weak conscience.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
So
that's right.
I don't think it's personal knowledge that makes it wrong.
No, it's what happens in the other person.
Just for clarification, in the case of a liberty, we can create an offense for somebody by them imitating our action with them not being convinced of the, whether it's a liberty or a law. But we can also cause stumbling when they imitate our action but don't understand the moral limitations within that liberty. And so you gave the example of watching a movie. Well, by someone seeing us watch a movie, they might be convinced, okay, I can watch a movie, that's clear in my conscience, but they might not understand the same restrictions on that.
Right.
And they might choose to watch just any movie. And could the same be true regarding Christmas as well? Someone could see somebody observing Christmas and observe Christmas, but carry it to another degree that would make it wrong.
That's true.
And then could you comment on Romans 14, 5, and 6 regarding the observance of days, the personal liberty to make special days in respect to Christmas?
Well, I don't know what day is actually talking about here. It's not talking about Christmas.
Right. I mean, what?
But I know. He says in verse 5, one man considers one day more sacred than another. Another man considers every day alike. Everyone should be fully convinced in his own mind. You know what happens sometimes in interpretation is that if we have some issue in the back of our mind that's really pressing to us, and we read the scripture, and we say, oh, yeah, that's what he's talking about. We relate, we have a purpose in our mind that we want to fulfill by reading the scripture, and then we read the scripture thinking that's the purpose that the author was trying to fulfill. And so we read this and it says, one man considers one day more sacred than another, another man considers every day. Oh, that's about days, you know. But that's not the point of this verse. The point is everyone should be fully convinced in his own mind. That's the point. And we can argue about what days you might have had in mind here, and we lose the point. The point of the passage is that you should not offend your conscience. And that you should be fully convinced in your own mind that what you do is right. And so, whatever we do, if we do it, this gets back to the practice, you know, if we do it, we have to make sure that we are convinced that it's right. Rather, right as a moral principle or right as my liberty to exercise it, we have to be convinced. Because if we do it doubting, then it not only offends our conscience, but it also leads us into temptation to do things always with doubting and practicing things that we're not sure about, and pretty soon we get the idea, well, you know, it doesn't matter. Who cares? I'll do it anyway. It leads to that kind of mentality. And that's the mentality people have sometimes because they're not careful about offending their conscience. They offend their conscience, they do things by doing things that they have doubts about. And eventually, it's easy to do things they have doubts about. And pretty soon, it doesn't matter whether to them to have knowledge or not, whether it's right or wrong. And it leads to destruction. And that's what happens. He says, don't destroy your brother by the exercise of your liberty. So that's, to me, the point of that passage.
Alan, if you could make it short, we've got two more. At least, we're running out of time.
Thank you very much for your lesson. I've enjoyed going back over the past little while and listening to different preachers who preached on Christian liberties, Romans 14 at the studies, and they do vary from speaker to speaker. On your moral principle, would it be appropriate to put law there? When I preach on Romans 14, I usually talk about law or liberty. Would that be appropriate enough?
Sure.
Okay. Then when I go a little further and I define law as that which is legislated by God, liberty is those things that are not legislated by God. Am I still on the right track as far as you're concerned? My study of Romans 14 did me a lot of good because it made me less judgmental of people. You know, in verse 19, it says, let us therefore follow after the things which make for peace and things wherewith one may edify another. In matters that we can have freedoms and liberties and relax, are areas that many times has caused friction and tension with people when we should be able to relax those type of issues. And that has helped me not to be so judgmental on issues. I can remember when we were raised in Georgia, we could not go skating. And the first time we came to Oklahoma New Year meeting and everybody went skating, we were just totally appalled. That was just something we thought everybody had stepped off the deep end of the earth. But now everybody goes skating, we do too, and have no conscience about it. But skating was one of them. It may have been an environmental where it was locally or not, but it was just a lot of things that have changed through the years. As I look over this audience today, I know one subject that I have no doubts in the minds of a lot of people, and I would ask if you just address it for us. You mentioned it earlier about apparel. You know, when we begin talking about apparel, there's one book one gentleman wrote a while back from the church that, and he said women cannot wear short sleeve blouses, have to be long sleeve, and told what colors it had to be, and on, what I consider rather radical and extreme. The moral principle or the law principle would be modesty. Modesty would fit that situation. The liberty would be whatever you wear that is modest. Would that be, is that correct?
So the discussion, right, the discussion is always focused on, unfortunately, the discussion always focuses on specific articles of clothing when we should back up and define the terms better. Because that's the problem, is that if one person is talking about modesty and defining it a certain way, and somebody else is talking about modesty and defining it a different way, then obviously they're going to come to different conclusions. So the discussion about which articles of clothing to wear is really a secondary discussion. The primary discussion should be, what do the words mean? What are the descriptive qualities of those words, the relevant descriptive qualities and characteristics of those words? And come to an agreement on that, and then we can apply them more clearly. But there's no, sometimes there's not enough clarity on the meaning of the terms.
Raymond, Jim Crouch asked most of my questions, so this will be brief. But when you talk about someone, say, partaking of something that is clearly a liberty because there's no moral principle against it, and he sins because he violates his conscience, it's a little bit hard for me to think that doing something that's all right and then feeling unrealistic about it is sin. Am I off base on that, or would you comment on it?
Who's, when you say you feel that way, what are you exercising liberty, or what are you?
I'm talking about somebody exercising liberty. You said someone, say, eats meat offered and sacrificed to idols, and he believes it's a sin, but it is a sin, but it's clearly a liberty. So how is just his unrealistic guilt a sin? I mean, Jim has the other side of that, and that is that he actually thinks it's all right then to worship the idol, and that would clearly be a sin. But I'm not clear. Incidentally, this is a minor point. I thought your talk was excellent.
It's a good point, though, because the sin actually is involved in the wounding of your conscience. That's the sin. The sin is not in the eating. If he's guilty of sin, the sin that he actually commits is wounding his conscience, is doing something that his conscience condemns himself for. Whatever, like Paul says, whatever is not of faith is of sin. So if we do something with doubts, whatever it is, if we do something with doubts, then we're wounding our conscience, and that's a sin to wound your conscience. Does that answer your question, James?
Well, it answers that, and it would be a clear answer, but I see so many people who have guilt about things that to me are clearly not wrong.
Right.
It looks to me like what we're doing is kind of talking in circles and saying, if you feel guilty, it's wrong to feel guilty, and you feel guilty because you feel guilty.
Well, yeah. No, I see what you're meaning now. You know, what I would do in a situation like that is firstly, down to explain to the person, you shouldn't feel guilty for doing this because it's a liberty, and try to get them the knowledge that he needs so that his conscience will not be offended. And that's where, if I were to talk with him personally, that's where my conversation would be focused on, is trying to get him to see that he doesn't need to feel guilty for this because it's not something that's wrong. But if I were to stand back and say, what's going on here? You know, is this person really sinning, and where is the sin happening? I would say, well,
the sin doesn't happen in eating of meat. The sin happens because he wounds his conscience. But if I were talking to him, that's, you know, what I would address him about would be that he doesn't need to feel good.
Dennis, has your question been answered?
Sir?
Has your question been answered?
No.
Make it short, we already have time.
Raymond, I think we all recognize that we have a moral principle to do to others as we would have them do it to us. And we have a moral principle to honor that in all things we do things sincerely and out of honesty and truth. Would you please comment on what the Apostle Peter said in 1 Peter 2 and verse 16, well, 15 and 16, where he said that we must do the will of God, and in well-doing or doing good, it will bring to silence those who in ignorance and foolishness would criticize. That's a little bit of a commentary there. It doesn't actually say that verbatim. But verse 16 says, and as for thee, and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Would you comment on people who use the cloak of liberty maliciously or selfishly to advance their own agenda?
Well, I'm not sure contextually that's what he's talking about. Live as free men, but don't use our freedom as says, as a cover-up for evil.
What does it mean to use your liberty as a cloak of maliciousness?
That's what I'm getting at, Vince. I believe that using your liberty as a cover-up for evil would be to say that I'm free. I'm a free man. I'm not a servant to anybody. Therefore, I can do as I please. And to excuse your evil by claiming freedom to do or freedom to act. And so anytime that somebody uses the claim to freedom to act as they want to, then they're using freedom to cover up evil as an excuse for evil. And instead what we should do is make our good open to everyone so they can see our good and recognize the distinction. There are many people that say, and they make this excuse, I'm free to do as I please. And when they claim freedom to cover up their evil, then they're doing that.
One
point.
Okay.
Would that include using an issue or building a straw man to fight maliciously? Would that include that? Would we be misusing our liberty or our freedoms as whoever we think we are to do that if we have malicious intent or if we're trying to advance another, our own personal agenda?
Well, I wouldn't be so concerned about trying to manipulate the context to try to say such a behavior was wrong when there's plenty of scriptures that condemn maliciousness. So I'd rather use scriptures that condemn maliciousness instead of trying to work that in the context of this passage.
So what you're saying is anything that is malicious, whether it's liberty or something
maliciousness
else,
period, is wrong. Maliciousness is doing something with an evil intent.
Right.
Being malicious is doing something with an evil purpose.
Or a hidden purpose.
Well, it's evil. If it's deceitful, it's evil.
Right.